I will call to order the Planning Commission meeting for Tuesday. It says May 6th, but it's July 1st, 2025. It is 6 o'clock. This meeting may also be viewed on Channel 20 and is available on live stream on the city's website and on www.slow-span.org. Members of the public may provide public comment during the meeting by calling 805-321-6639. The phone line is now open. I've invited Commissioner Holden to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. If you'd all stand, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Ms. Ratana, would you please call the roll?
Commissioner Halverson?
Here.
Commissioner Holden?
Here.
Vice Chair Swift?
Here.
Chair Mann?
Here.
And please let the record show that Commissioner Hoffman is not present.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to the agenda review. At this time, the Planning Commission will review the order of business to be conducted and receive requests for or make announcements regarding any changes in the order of the day. And then we will, by motion, adopt the agenda as presented or revised. Does staff or any commissioners have any requests for changes to the agenda? No. Seeing none. I did have one question, which is that for items 3 and 4, item 3 has a DA number, but item 4 does not. Is that because they are part of the same DA?
The other one has a ODR number, right?
I don't see a number at all. So.
ORD. Yeah, so they're in two different systems. So our new software system had a new application number assignment. So it should be ORD-25-0001.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I don't know if that needs to be approved as a change, but no, I don't think so. Okay. So do I have a motion to approve the agenda?
I move we approve the agenda as submitted.
And do I have a second?
I'll second the motion.
And this is a voice vote. All in favor, state aye.
Aye.
Aye. I hear no opposed or abstentions. The motion passes unanimously. Coming up on, there are multiple times for public communication and public comment in this meeting. The first one that we do is for things that are not on the agenda. So we allow public communication. Any member of the public may address the commission for a period of not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest not on the agenda and within the jurisdiction of this commission. The commission will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, the commission cannot act on items not on the agenda. If you are new to public comment, it is helpful if you fill out a slip telling us the item that you're going to speak on and give that to Clerk Ratana. And there are our rules of conduct are on the last page of the agenda, which I believe there's some copies over there. So if you haven't done it before, you need a refresher, that's there. So I will open public comment for items not on the agenda. Would anyone like to speak? I have two names here for one for general public comment. Brenda Auer, are you here?
Yeah.
Please come forward.
Good evening, everyone. Cassandra, I found what I was looking for. It's all good. I want to ask a favor of you all. I understand that the city does not protect private views, but I'm told we protect public views, like Pismo does from the freeway. And I'm asking you, please, drive up and down 8th Street, actually drive down 8th Street. Think about how these new buildings that are going to be built will affect the actual public views. Please take your time to do that. I think I asked you last time we were here. And if you haven't, I ask again. I was told to have drawings put where the views would be taken over. And I was told I could spend my own money and have somebody come and, I don't know, computer generate it. Maybe we need to go back to putting up the poles, so we can actually see like we used to be able to. of how our views are being affected, especially those public views. I know my view is not protected. It's private. But I live in a street where people actually sit in front of my house to see the view, because there is one. Please, please, I ask you to do that. I also want to know that there's a lot of people really, really disappointed that we're currently tearing up a perfectly good park. So you guys are kind of our watchdogs as well as the community. If things like this come up in the future, maybe we should think about applying for grants for sewer instead of park upgrades. And maybe we shouldn't start the work before we have all the funds. It's a thought. Wouldn't it be terrible if that hole got left there the way it is now because we ran out of money, which we don't have all the money? I understand when we get grants, we need to spend them, get them to the contractors, make those people rich. Maybe we need to take a break, take a breath, and look what's really going on. I appreciate you listening to me, and I know I'm seeing some of you actually look at me like you hear me, so thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you very much. Next, for general public comment, I have Lauren, is it Westenhall?
Westfall.
Thank you, Lauren. Or Ms. Westfall, whatever you prefer.
W-E-S-T-P-H-A-L. Lauren, good evening. My questions are really easy. When neighbors apply for the ADU permit, I understand they no longer have to be primary residents. However, my question is, when an ADU is being permitted, does it come before you guys before it's approved? And my other question is, are residents or surrounding nearby, are they informed as the city no longer puts up signs saying what's going on or the polls? So those are my two questions this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have that on the agenda in item 4, so we will try to answer your questions at that time. But thank you for your comment. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on items that are not on the agenda at this time? I don't see anyone in the room raising their hand. Is there anyone on the phone line?
No, there's not.
Hearing there's no one else there for this part of the public hearing or public communication, I will close public communication. We now move on to the consent agenda, which today is just the acceptance of the minutes from the last meeting, which was May 6th. I do need to open public comment on this, so I will go ahead and do so. Is there any member of the public who wishes to address the commission on the item listed under the consent agenda? If so, please call in at 805-321-6639. Is there anyone in the room who wanted to speak on the item on consent agenda? I'm not seeing any nodding heads. Is there anyone on the line? All right, I will close public comment for that. So, are there any, do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I move we approve the consent agenda.
And do I have a second?
I second.
This is a roll call vote. So, Clerk Ratana, would you kindly call the roll?
Commissioner Holden? I'm sorry. Commissioner Holden?
Yeah.
Yes. Mr. Halverson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Swift?
Yes.
Chairman?
Yes. Motion passes unanimously. Moving on to the first of our public hearing items. This is a development application. This is item 2. Development application 20-25-0013. The applicant is Andy Mendoza, and Associate Planner Janet Reese will give us a presentation.
Good evening. Here we go. We'll be reviewing an application to consider an indoor commercial recreation facility tonight that will be within an existing warehouse located at 45 Newport. The project site is located at the intersection of Newport Avenue and Front Street. The project site is bordered by the railroad and Highway 1 to the west, and then commercial and industrial buildings primarily to the north, south, and east. There's also some non-conforming residential structures to the south. The project site is located in the coastal industrial commercial zone. The property was developed in the 1970s with three attached warehouse and manufacturing buildings totaling approximately 20,000 square feet. Approximately 9,000 square foot building on the east portion of the site that's got some blue stripes on it. Kind of see. It's currently vacant and the subject of tonight's application. The applicant is requesting approval of a coastal development permit and use permit to establish and operate an indoor commercial recreation facility, specifically in this case, an indoor baseball and softball training or practice facility within the 9,000 square foot building. The project aims to offer a dedicated training space for local baseball and softball teams and players, addressing a need not currently met in the South County area. The facility would provide five indoor batting cages available by reservation. In addition to the installation of the batting cages, a sales counter and seating will be installed. The project is required to be consistent with the local coastal program, the general plan, the industrial design guidelines, and development code. The city's adopted local coastal program ensures development within the coastal zone aligns with California's Coastal Act objectives. The project does not involve any site changes or intensification of use of the property. Therefore, the project is in compliance with all applicable policies outlined in the local coastal program. The project is consistent with the city's general plan by supporting the city's goals for economic development and efficient use of existing industrial spaces. The proposed indoor commercial recreation facility provides a compatible use within the commercial and industrial zone, utilizing an otherwise vacant and underutilized warehouse. The industrial design guidelines serve as best practices for enhancing industrial development and are intended to apply to new construction and redevelopment projects where a use or development permit is required. The site was developed in the 1970s prior to the adoption of these guidelines. As a result, the existing building and materials and site layout do not reflect the standards in the guidelines. However, since no significant physical changes to the building or site are proposed, the design guidelines are not applicable to this project. The development code, the site is located within the coastal industrial commercial zone, which is intended for light and medium manufacturing and similar compatible uses, such as the proposed commercial recreational facility, which is an allowable use within the zone with a use permit to evaluate whether the proposed use is compatible with the surrounding development and site-specific conditions, such as the number of parking spaces. Chapter 3 of the Development Code establishes the required number of parking spaces by the use. For typical industrial uses of warehousing or manufacturing, the Development Code requires one parking space for every 750 square feet of indoor floor area. Because the project site is developed with 20,000 square feet of building area, the building or the site would require 27 parking spaces under today's code. The site currently provides 15 on-site and 4 on-street parking spaces for a total of 19 spaces. As a result, the site and development are considered legal non-conforming. For the proposed use, parking requirements for an indoor commercial recreation facility must be provided at one space for every 500 square feet versus 100 instead of one for every 750 square feet. For the 9,000 square feet of area, this would result in a total of 18 parking spaces. The development code requires parking spaces be provided for the proposed use. However, physical constraints of the property do not allow the addition of the additional 6 spaces to meet the required 33 without significant reconfiguration or redevelopment of the site. As part of the proposed project, the applicant requested a reduction in the number of required parking spaces due to the physical constraints of the site and its operational characteristics. The development code does offer flexibility as a means to minimize the number of required spaces by allowing reductions for projects that have special conditions, such as operational characteristics, or if the existing site configuration or size render the parking requirement unreasonable or impractical. For the review authority, in this case the Planning Commission, to grant the parking reduction, a parking demand study is required. Specific findings required are related to the characteristics of the site and location of the existing structures, and improvements must render the full compliance with parking standards impractical. Staff completed the parking demand analysis on behalf of the applicant, utilizing the Institute of Transportation Engineers, or ITE, parking generation guidelines. In the middle of the chart is where their standards are. So for the warehouse, for 11,000 square feet, their parking ratio is 1 for every 200 or 2,500 square feet, which results in 4 parking spaces. For a recreational center, ITE's most similar use to our proposed indoor recreation facility, they call it a recreational community center. The parking requirement is 1 per 500 square feet of active floor area, not the total floor area. The proposed batting cages occupy approximately one-third of the 9,000 square foot unit, and the batting cage area is not accessible for circulation or other active use. As such, this area should not be counted as active floor area for parking purposes. The remaining 6,000 square feet is considered active use area and results in 12 parking spaces. The total parking demand using these standards is estimated at 16 spaces for the whole site, where there is 19 currently provided. The facility will operate by reservation only between the hours of 9 a.m. and 8 p.m., encouraging staggered arrivals and group visits. Staff finds that the operational characteristics constitute special conditions that justify a reduced parking requirement. The parking demand analysis demonstrates that the existing parking at the site can reasonably accommodate the proposed use. The site overall remains in a non-conforming state related to parking, and therefore the request for the reduction is applicable. Following staff's analysis, the request for a parking reduction from the calculated 33 spaces to 16 is appropriate. Additionally, the existing building footprint and site layout is physically constrained the ability to add any additional parking spaces without substantial reconfiguration or demolition of existing improvements. Such changes would be impractical and inconsistent with the City Council's adopted goals supporting business attraction and retention. Staff has evaluated the project's consistency with relevant requirements and found it to be consistent with current standards. Therefore, tonight's recommendation is to find the project consistent with the general plan and development code and approve the coastal development permit, use permit, parking reduction subject to findings and conditions. And that concludes staff's presentation.
Thank you very much, Associate Planner Reese. So at this point, it is the commission's chance to ask questions of staff. I will start with the alphabetical. Commissioner Halverson.
I have no questions.
Commissioner Holden.
Are we going to hear from the owner?
We will hear from the applicant after
the
this.
Applicant. And then, okay, yeah. I just have questions for him.
Okay. Vice Chair Swift.
I do have a question. Can you go back to your, it's like your second slide that showed the blue hash marks over the one building? Yes, so I was only a little confused before I came here. Now I'm really confused. The blue hash marked building that you have there on the right, isn't that occupied by Grover Beach Police Department for their rec facility and vehicle storage?
No, this is the police department storage, is this long part of the site.
Okay.
If I can provide some clarification, there's two tenant suites within these buildings, And so the other tenant suite is occupied by the police department, and this site is operating independently.
And so you're saying that the left of those two buildings is the PD, not the right?
Correct.
The westerly building is occupied by PD.
Right, and this little bit here is occupied by somebody else. This has a Front Street address, so a little corner.
So in your analysis, you didn't really talk about the parking needs for PD and their use of that facility, right? You treat it as a warehouse.
Correct.
But it's not really a warehouse. It is storing some equipment, but it's also the PD's rec facility, training facility. And so it seems to me that that would qualify that as another recreational facility use in running parking calculations, right? It's not just a warehouse.
Okay. Community Development Director Megan Martin. So the warehouse that's utilized for the police facility is able to be parked on the westernmost side of the building where the roll-up doors are already located. So their parking is accounted for. There also was no need for a parking calculation, as it was simply a building permit. There was no discretionary review associated with the occupancy of that building as storage. Its primary use is as storage. Its secondary or accessory use is as a recreation facility for police officers should they need, you know, to work out after hours. But use of that facility does not warrant the additional need for parking. And the parking calculation that was included here accounts for all parking required by the smaller manufacturing warehouse facility that's in the upper left, the PD facility, as well as the square footage for what the applicant's requesting.
And the PD was okay with giving up some portion of their parking for this?
Correct.
New use.
Both uses apply a staggered parking operations. So PD is not there 24/7. It is accessible 24/7, but it's not used 24/7. In fact, probably majority of the visits are either moving the storage in and out and or after hours, when you're less likely to see other commercial uses in the vicinity using the area, whereas this is an all-day use but staggered and by reservations only. So all of that was considered as part of our overall calculations. But for this, we completed an independent parking demand analysis to support the applicant and their request, which would have otherwise cost possible a couple $1,000s to complete the demand study.
Yeah, the only reason I'm asking about the PD is because you're counting the entire facility square footage and its proposed usage, and then all of the parking places to serve the entire three tenants is what we're talking about, right?
Correct.
And so, when I looked at the analysis, I didn't see all the parking spaces that were being discussed the property.
If I could jump in on this one, that's mostly because the PD operation is not open to the public. So the parking requirements would differ under an ITE parking demand. Yeah. So that's the biggest difference between the two activities.
And in addition to that, the visits to just speaking from my own experience and visiting the site and touring it with our police chief as well as our former police chief, visits to the PD facility are short-term in duration. It's not extended periods of time for probably more than, I don't even want to say a number. It's short durations of visits unless absolutely necessary. And then, like I said, after hours for their rec component.
And so, can you show me on your map where the parking spaces are that serve the whole complex to meet your proposed reduced parking numbers?
Yeah, can you go back to that one?
So there, if I remember correctly, there are five over here, two here, four here. There are four under this office area, two on the street here, and two or three up here. Two. So the ones you don't see visually are the under the office.
Under the awning at the entryway. Yeah. Under the office building.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I had two questions. One is, do we know how long the property has been vacant?
I don't recall.
We don't know.
When they left. And or
then
when
regarding our warehouse parking requirement, it sounds like that came into being after this was built.
Our current
like our current parking requirement that's one per 750 square foot would have came into existence after this was originally
correct
built. Okay.
I could add to that. When the back in 1970, the original parking requirement for warehouses was one space per 2,000 square feet. Since 1970, it did change from one per 2,000 square feet to 1,750 square feet at some point in time. I don't have that data with me.
But the number that has been looked at now in recent years is one for 2,500. Is that what
the 750.
I'm
not saying for us, but the one that we're
correct.
Using.
Correct. For ITE parking demand, would be one space per 2,500 square feet.
Okay. That was just historical questions. Moving on, since we've gotten, okay, commissioners, do their questions. All right, I will open public comment. I do want to reiterate that if you want to call in for public comment, 805-321-6639 for item 2. The phone line is open. Please do call in. So I will open public comment, and I will start with the applicant.
Hello. Do you guys have any questions for me?
I have.
How do I hear this? Can we have a conversation or how do? Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you intend to have birthday parties? I mean, that would bring a lot of cars.
Yeah. No. Not really. No.
It doesn't look like there's space to have.
Yeah.
Kids' birthday parties.
Yeah.
Teams coming for batting practice, also.
Yes, teams would. Majority of teams that are going to come, I'm sure they're going to drop off their kid. As a dad that has a kid playing ball, well, used to play ball, I just drop them off.
Yeah, okay.
And pick them up because I don't want to be waiting around and play daddy coach.
That was my questions.
Are there any other questions for the applicant? I don't have any.
Okay.
But if things come up, we can go back to that. Did anyone else want to speak for public comment on this development application for the batting cage facility? Please come on forward. Oh, yes. I do have a Kevin. Are you Kevin Bates?
Correct.
Sorry. I found this.
Chairmembers, commissioners, thank you. My name is Kevin Bates. I'm a Rio Grande resident, but I'm here tonight as the president of Rio Grande Valley Little League. Someone who's really excited about this business coming into Grover. Through Little League, we're committed to teaching youth in our community the ideals of good sportsmanship, honesty, loyalty, courage, and respect. Last year, we directly impacted over 500 families in the South County area from Shell Beach just to in the south of Rio Grande, just before Nipomo. Positive recreation areas in this community are lacking. We have some areas for skating, things like that, but where you can go in a confined environment with a coach, with family, anything like that, to have a positive influence on kids doing sports is an amazing thing for us to be excited about. As a coach for many years with Little League, we struggle to find areas for us to help keep kids engaged in baseball and softball in the off season. Football and soccer take a lot of the field space, and the Soto Sports Complex, where we primarily do all of our practices and games, is closed from December through March for field renovation. Inevitably, March rolls around and we get fields opened up and it starts raining. So we're always looking for places to practice. As a coach, we've taken our kids up to Flippo's in Morro Bay many times. And, you know, about like the applicant said, it's primarily one or two coaches, 12 kids, and then the parents, they go off and get lunch, they go run errands, and it's the parking's easy. And looking at the map, I think Flippo's had less parking than what this has shown at this point. So. Parking, I don't really think is going to be too big of a concern, coming from someone who's actually kind of been into those situations. In finishing, to have a place in the Five Cities where individuals and teams can come together to work on skills in a positive and controlled environment is extremely exciting to the baseball families in the South County area, and we're extremely excited for this business. It's for the kids. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on this item? Please come forward.
Lauren Westfall. Real quick, I like this idea. However, just to let the people here know, there is no parking on Front Street. Once 197 and the condos become occupied. Since there's no parking for them, they're going to be hitting all those streets, just to let you guys know that.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on item two? Seeing no one in the room, is there anyone online or on the phone line?
No, there's not.
Okay, then I will close public comment on item two. So, commissioners, discussion with ourselves. Any questions you want to ask the commission?
I just have a comment that...
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I just have a comment that I think it's really cool. Thanks.
Commissioner Halverson? I'm sorry, I reversed the alphabet.
I know, I was very confused. Oh. I don't know. I started talking.
I was looking in this direction first.
Yeah, I think it's a great project, and I can't wait for it to be operational. I guess the question, the only reason really probably it came to the Planning Commission is because of the parking issue and the variance from what our guidelines show. And I guess a suggestion for staff for follow-on proposals is to be a little more clear about this. There's obviously three organizations that are utilizing this same group of parking places. And your chart only really accounted for the new proposed project. And yeah, maybe the police don't need one, so we didn't count them. This other business, I don't even know what it is. You guys don't either. Probably needs some parking during the day. Your analysis may have shown, it didn't, but it could have shown that the utilization of the batting cages would be more on the weekends and more after school and that sort of thing. And that would change the demand for parking on these limited spaces. So just a request for the future. If you could be more specific and definitive in your presentation, that would be great. So because of the reasons I said, because of, I think, the different times for demand for parking at these three different businesses, I don't think this is ever going to be an issue. So I don't have any objections to the project. I think it's going to be good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Swift.
I'm going to say more about parking. I'll say a lot more about parking later, but I think to Ms. Westfall's point and to Dave's point is that looking at any of these projects in a vacuum and the parking need for a specific piece of the project, I think in the long term is going to miss the broader parking challenges in that area of the city. Because sure, at certain times there will be, you know, the PD might not be using theirs or the batting cages might not be using theirs, but that entire busy corner of, you know, sort of PCH to 8th Street of people coming to visit downtown and looking for off-street parking because there's no public parking will be out in these streets. So, yes, from a purely focused point of this project and its demand and parking needs for that specific location, for the times they're going to use it, I think makes perfect sense. But again, when we talk about some of these other items later, I will say it again. We are creating a future parking problem in those surrounding neighborhoods parallel to Grand that, you know, if we give up a few parking spaces and push cars to the streets on every project, then there is going to be full streets. All the street spots will be filled. And I seem to remember this commission and the council not 2 years ago saying those are public streets, not places for private citizens to store their personal property. And in so doing, they passed a parking ordinance that will force people to move their cars around. So with that in mind, this project is a great project, but we can't keep waving off parking problems to the future because they're going to get here sooner than you think.
Thank you very much. I will just say that I think it's a great use for this space, and I wish you'd maybe think about doing small parties because I'd like to take a couple girlfriends and learn how to bat.
ride your bike.
But I can ride my bike because I live here in town. I do think, especially if it's a lot of youth, you may see a lot more bike. I don't know. We haven't looked at bike parking here. That's not a requirement of the city that I understand. But I'm sure that you can look into that and figure that out. So, yeah, I love that this is happening, and I think it's going to be great for visitors, too. So thanks for bringing it forward. All right. So anything else from the commissioners? I will invite a motion to adopt the resolution for item 2, development application 25-0013.
All right. I move that we approve development application DA 25-0013.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Clerk Cortana, would you please call the roll?
Commissioner Halverson?
Yes.
Commissioner Holden?
Yes.
Vice Chair Swift?
Yes.
And Chair Mann?
Yes. The motion passes unanimously. Moving on to item 3. And as a reminder, for those tuning in at home, if you did want to speak on item 3, which is the 20... I'll allow the room to vacate here. Item 3 is the 2024 Development Code Amendments, DA 24-36. The applicant is the City of Grover Beach, and Senior Planner Kyle Bell will be presenting. As a reminder, if you'd like to call in for public comment on item 3, please call in at 805-321-6639. Senior Planner Bell.
All right. Good evening. Tonight we will present an overview of recent updates to the city's development code. These updates include continue our effort to align local regulations with evolving state laws, particularly those close to housing, land use, and coastal compliance. Since the city council adopted the development code last fall, staff has... lost my slide. There we go. okay. Since the City Council adopted the development code last fall, staff has worked to incorporate feedback from California Department of Housing and Community Development, also known as HCD, and the Coastal Commission. Our goal is to ensure the code remains legally compliant, internally consistent, and responsive to state mandates and local priorities. This evening's discussion focuses on the refinements made since the ordinance was last presented to Council. We've separated the ADU-related amendments to allow for a more focused review of the broader code updates. Copies of the amendments are available for public review here in the council chambers. We've identified the improvements since February as purple. Any of the highlights in red in the updates are to reference the latest changes under HCD's comments and Coastal Commission review, as well as some updates related to Planning Commission policy. The Community Development Department is committed to annually reviewing the development code to stay current with best practices and state requirements. This comprehensive update aims to align our local regulations with state housing and land use laws, reduce regulatory barriers, and improve clarity and consistency across the code. While many updates were introduced last fall, this report also includes revisions made in response to Coastal Commission and HCD feedback. Because the project has not been certified by the Coastal Commission yet, we are revisiting and representing the entirety of the update to ensure full compliance. To provide context, this project builds on the city's broader effort to modernize and streamline the development code. The process began with the adoption of the housing element in November of 2020, followed by a comprehensive development code update in June of 2022, both supported by state grant funding. As part of those grant commitments, staff committed to conducting annual updates to ensure the code stays aligned with state law and best practices. In 2024, the next phase began. The City Council held a study session on May 28th, followed by a community workshop and survey on June 18th. And then on August 6th, the Planning Commission recommended approval of the proposed amendments. On August 26th, 2024, the City Council conducted the first reading of the ordinance, followed by adoption at the second reading on September 9th. Because part of the city lies within the coastal zone, the ordinance is subject to review and certification by the Coastal Commission. However, the Coastal Commission now requires that all ADU-related amendments be submitted to the Department of Housing and Community Development prior to review by Coastal. That referral was made on September 12th. Then on December 24th, HCD provided preliminary comments known as a flyover review. In response, staff revised the ordinance to align with state law and housing HCD's guidance. The revised ordinance was reintroduced to the City Council on February 26, 2025. However, due to concerns about the proposed ADU heights, Council remanded the item back to Planning Commission for further review and discussion, bringing us to today's presentation. To frame today's discussion, it's important to understand the key drivers behind these updates. First, recent state legislation, particularly SB 1123, expands urban lot subdivisions to include single-family residential zones. Second, the Coastal Act requires coordination with Coastal Commission to protect coastal resources and align local policies with state requirements. Finally, evolving ADU laws, along with detailed HCD review, have prompted important clarifications and updates to the ADU regulations. Together, these mandates and agency reviews have shaped the proposed amendments. The proposed amendments on the screen focus aligning the development code with recent state housing laws and incorporating guidance from HCD. First, ADUs are now permitted in industrial zones when accessory to an existing residential use, such as live-work or supportive housing. Second, a note was added under the edge condition setback table, clarifying that ADUs must follow state law, including the 4-foot side and rear yard setback requirement. Third, to comply with SB 1123, urban lot subdivisions standards were updated to allow for qualifying subdivisions within the R1 zones that are on vacant lots. Finally, three key definitions, ADUs, accessory structures, and single unit dwellings, were revised for state law consistency and to improve clarity throughout the code. These next amendments improved clarity and consistency in applying development code standards and processing permits. First, under the height limits, a minor change now allows for elevator towers to exceed the height limits pursuant to the approval of a use permit, similar to other architectural features in the code. Second, a cross-reference to the administrative coastal development permits was added within the administrative development permits section to clarify when coastal regulations apply. Third, the administrative coastal development permit section now references both administrative permits and zoning clearance requirements, ensuring consistent procedures for projects in the coastal zones. These revisions to the development code are administrative in nature and will not cause any direct or indirect physical change on the environment. As a result, they are exempt from review under CEQA. Following the Planning Commission's recommendation and the City Council's consideration, staff will submit the approved changes to the Coastal Commission. Once Coastal Commission approves the city's local coastal program amendment, these updates will take effect throughout the inland and coastal areas of the city. And tonight's recommendation is for the Planning Commission to forward the changes to the City Council for final adoption and approve the associated local coastal program amendment. And this concludes the presentation. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you very much, Senior Planner Bell. So now is the time for commissioners to ask questions of staff. I will start with Commissioner Halverson.
All right. Well, I don't think I have any questions. I would have asked them before the meeting if I had, because I went through the whole thing. I started to have questions and things were crossed off, and then I found them later on. Moved a lot of things around, and hopefully that will help clarify things and make it more simple to read and follow. So I don't have any real questions. It all seemed to make sense. A lot of it, of course, is driven by the state once again telling us what to do. So we have done that. So good job, guys, and that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Holden.
I have nothing.
Vice Chair Swift.
This is questions, not comments, right?
Questions of staff, and then we can talk amongst ourselves later.
No questions on
I had one question that I noticed, thinking about how in the previous meeting we had to determine. We discovered we needed to add the elevator shaft situation. This is kind of in the weeds here, but going back to the guardrails and stairs. So this is section 3.10.080. I want to understand, so in that, in subsection F, there's an alternative compliance, which means that the modification of standards process can apply to subsection D, which is additional setbacks. But it does not apply to any other subsection. Does it apply to any other subsection? For example, subsection E, which is the guardrail and stair.
No, it does not. You are correct.
Okay, so here's my concern, is that in cases where the original design of a building, so for repairs and remodels, in cases where the original design is in conflict with the new code, for example, there's an existing wood staircase that's visible from the street, which the new code would not allow, but it's rotting and needs to be replaced, do we tell them you just can't replace it?
We have actually had this come up several times since I started working here, and internal policy, if the percent change of said deck, railing, stairway, et cetera, does not exceed, and I believe we've used 25% in the past, does not exceed a percentage of the total size of the structure, we will allow them to replace in kind. It would be unreasonable and not roughly proportional to the change that they're asking for to require that the entire structure be brought back into compliance. So to answer your question, we would not require any kind of discretionary level of review. We would allow them to replace the deck, the stairs, et cetera, in kind, so long as it doesn't exceed a certain percentage of the total size of the structure.
Okay. And so with that, if the current guardrail, for example, for a balcony is a baluster style, which does not have 50% opacity, would that also be permitted to be, for example, a unit that doesn't conform to 4 inches between balusters, which I believe is a building code thing now, would need to be brought up to 4 inches between balusters, I would presume.
Yes.
But would it need to be brought up to the new code of the opacity rule?
Correct.
So a guardrail would also, like a guardrail on a staircase?
Exterior staircase?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is all covered under the non-conforming structure section of the development code.
Okay.
So we would refer back to that to verify that any improvements made to a non-conforming structure are made in line with those regulations. And it does provide a lot of flexibility.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That was all the questions I had. I didn't want to go back to the guardrail thing, but I had to. Okay. All right. Now we will move on to the public comment portion 4, item 3, which is everything except the ADU stuff. And I will remind anyone watching, you can call in at 805-321-6639. And I will open public comment. Is there any member of the public who wishes to comment on item 3?
Actually, I have more of a question. So the height limit is, I see 25 feet and then I saw 15 feet. Is the height limit 25 feet, 2 stories for an ADU or a junior ADU?
I think this is part of item 4, which is why we separated the ADU question out. But we can hold that question for that discussion.
And then is it different for multifamily rather than single family, the height limit? And then the one thing I want to communicate that I've been asked to address that was addressed last meeting, a month ago or so, was the 4-foot setback. I mean, if I got chickens, I think I still have to have them 7 feet from the fence. I'm not sure. But I know somebody that's property, their backyard, their house sits back, so their backyard is not very far from the fence. And if somebody builds a second-story ADU, they're really invading on their privacy. And, of course, 4 feet's not very much of a difference, you know, between that and the fence. But just something to consider because a lot of people have moved here. I sell real estate. They spent high dollars to maybe have their little piece of paradise, and they don't want it invaded. I know we can't change too much, too many things, but, you know, two or three ADUs on a property is a lot, and then not requiring parking. We're back to the parking situation. Thanks.
Thank you for your comment. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on item three? So anything outside of the ADU? I don't see anyone raising their hand in the room. Is there anyone on the line?
There is not.
Okay, I would like to alert the commissioners. I think we all received, there was correspondence for items three and four from SLOCO YIMBY. So if you haven't had a chance to review that, just take a quick minute. And try to treat the write-ins the same way as our people in person and on the phone. All right, if there's no other comment, I will close the public comment portion. So, commissioners, we have things to discuss.
Thank you.
I'll start with you, Chair, Commissioner Halverson.
Oh, I almost got to be chair again. I think what I said before is still true. I don't really have any concerns about this. Most of it is administrative changes and clarifications and that sort of thing. There's not a lot of meat to discuss about changes that we would consider. So I don't have any other discussion except to make it happen.
Commissioner Holden.
I don't have anything.
Vice Chair Swift.
So I had asked some questions of Community Development Director Martin before the meeting, trying to hone in on my concern about building heights. And it was really triggered by both our review of peak Wi-Fi and the elevator mechanicals that gave them an additional height in their envelope, and concern for 401, 402, 197 Grand. And to a lesser degree, Mr. Bischoff's developments on the south side. But in sort of trying to put my finger on my worry with all that is, you know, what is my worry about the height? And I think what it boiled down to me is that we're still treating the top of the building as the top of the covered occupied space, right? So if there's a rooftop open space, the floor of the rooftop open space is considered the height of the building. And all of the stuff on top of that is not included in the height calculation. Is that correct?
I can jump in if you like to answer. I can answer that question if necessary. So, under the upper story open space requirements, all roof deck equipments and, say, pergola or furniture or guardrails or
pergola,
parapet, all of that's included in the maximum height, not allowed to exceed.
So in an R1 where somebody puts up a two-story with a roof deck, the maximum envelope of that two-story with a roof deck to the top of their pergola sitting on their roof deck, not including their umbrellas, but to the pergola, is 25 feet.
Yeah, actually, I think including the umbrellas.
It includes all furniture on said rooftop deck.
Even the furniture?
Mm-hmm. Everything.
And so for 401, 402, their height envelope included everything on the roof, the stairwell.
The maximum height of their elevator tower is 53 feet.
53 feet. Mm-hmm. And so they ended up not like peak Wi-Fi encroaching on that space because they forgot the mechanicals. Peak Wi-Fi, basically, we had to deal with the additional
Correct.
Piece because of the mechanicals for the elevator. So you're saying that the way the code is currently written, it is treated as an envelope. So whether they put another floor of dwellings up there or they put a roof deck, the maximum envelope within the zone encompasses all of the equipment needed to service that open space, except the mechanicals, which we've given a use permit for. But the building doesn't go to the top of the occupied floors, and then anything above the roof is bonus.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I'm no longer worried as much.
I'm glad you asked that. Yeah. As we've looked at a lot of this, you know, over the past year and a half, really, it looks like And I'm just reminded that the state laws that are coming on are there to help us. And the code should serve what we want the outcomes to be. And I think that this code does. So did I have any other questions or comments that I need to make now? I don't think I do. So any other discussion among the commission? All right, I will invite a motion to approve development application 24-36.
I move we approve, adopt, I guess.
I guess it's adopt a resolution, yeah. Sorry.
Development application 2436.
Do I have a second?
I second.
Clerk Hurtado, would you please call the roll?
Commissioner Holden?
Yes.
Commissioner Halverson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Swift?
Yes.
Chair Mann?
Yes. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Moving on to the ADU portion of this, this is item 4, which has a number, which you said is ORD
25-0001.
Okay. 25-0001. The applicant is the City of Grover Beach, and Senior Planner Bell will give us a presentation on this part.
And just real quick, I wanted to note that we did hear the comments about the accessory dwelling units as part of the last presentation, but we do welcome any more comments related to ADUs as part of this presentation. Just to make sure that we didn't miss that as part of the last item. Okay, jumping right in. This next presentation focuses on the proposed updates to the city's ADU regulations. These updates are part of the standalone ordinance that was separated from the broader development code update in order to respond directly to comments made from HCD and to ensure consistency with recent changes in state law. While the city initially adopted the ADU regulations last fall, HCD raised several comments requiring clarification. As a result, staff has revised the ordinance to reflect both technical refinements and practical updates necessary to maintain compliance. We'll walk through the key changes and explain the reasoning behind them, provide an overview of ADU state law, and outline the next steps. And as with the previous item, hard copies are available. The purple underlined revisions were made from the previous review last fall, and the red underlined revisions are the responses to HCD comments as well as COSL. All right, before we get into the specifics of the changes, I want to briefly highlight the regulatory context that brought us here. First, because Grover Beach is partly within the COSL zone, any changes to the ADU regulations require certification by the COSL Commission. However, before COSL Commission can act, new procedures now require that HCD review any ADU-related ordinance first. Second, recent state law legislation, Senate Bill 1211, expanded ADU allowances on multi-unit properties. That bill now permits up to 8 detached ADUs on lots with existing multi-family housing, depending on number of existing units. And finally, HCD completed what is called a flyover review of our original ordinance, and provided a set of detailed comments. The updates presented tonight directly respond to the feedback, ensuring full alignment with the state law and setting the stage for the Coastal Commission certification. And before we dive into this next part, we did want to offer maybe a different approach to this presentation. From here, we can dive right into the regulatory regulations of state law, explaining how ADUs are interpreted under state law, or we can dive into the changes being presented. We weren't sure what the commission would prefer to start with. It's going to be a lot of information, and we're going to take breaks to answer questions as we go through it, but we wanted to leave it up to you to see what you want to tackle first, the changes to the code or overview of state law.
We have an opinion.
overview of state law. I think pictures of what is being interpreted would be great.
Yeah, and I think since this is being recorded, if people need to come back for it, it'd be helpful to have it on the record. So if you would, please.
All right, I'll continue on. Before diving into the discussion, our team thought it might be helpful to set the stage in understanding how state law classifies ADUs and what local authority we have regulating them. Under Government Code 66314, bear with me, there'll be repeats of these numbers a lot, we're allowed to apply objective development standards to what are referred to as locally regulated ADUs. These include things like height, setback, and design, provided those standards do not conflict with state allowances. In contrast, Government Code 66323 outlines what are called state-exempt ADUs. These ADUs are essentially exempt from all local standards, and cities are required to approve them ministerially as long as they meet the baseline requirements set by the state. So, throughout this ordinance, you'll see distinctions between what the city can regulate and where state law preempts local control. This framework guides how we approach the updates, especially in balancing flexibility for homeowners with appropriate development standards.
Can you describe what your pictures were trying to communicate?
I got you. All right, we're going to, up first, we have detached ADUs, which are standalone units that are physically separate from the primary residence. The way that they're regulated depends whether they fall under the local authority or are considered state exempt. Under Government Code 66314, under Government Code 66314, the city can apply objective standards such as height, lot coverage, and location and size, and so long as those standards don't unreasonably restrict development. On the other hand, state-exempt detached ADUs are exempt from all local standards. However, these units are limited to 800 square feet in size when accessory to a proposed or existing single-family dwelling unit. The maximum height of a detached ADU is 16 feet on a property with a single-family dwelling unit and 18 feet on a property with a multifamily dwelling unit. For projects that are located within a half mile of the train station, the maximum height shall be 18 feet, and it'll also allow for an additional 2 feet for the roof pitch, so long as it's consistent with the primary dwelling.
I hate to interrupt, but the whole train station business, is this the transportation center? Well, but to put it on the slide now is misleading.
Oh,
because you're saying it's 18 feet because it's within a half mile of train station. The train station is our Grover Beach train station. No.
It's actually my next statement here.
Okay. Sorry, but I didn't want to head this off on a misunderstanding.
Absolutely. We are on the same page. These height allowances are driven by state mandates and must be incorporated into the ordinance, even though our local train station may not directly meet the intent of the legal definition of a major transit stop. In other words, HCD requires these changes to our ordinance, regardless of our current interpretation of the major transit stop that we're currently working on with HCD to refine.
If I could provide just one additional bit of information. So we have pushed back fairly extensively with HCD on this. There's even more recent state law that further defines major transit stop. And when I brought that to light to our representative at HCD, because it isn't in effect and in law yet, they can't rely on that to define major transit stop. So HCD will still assert that it is a major transit stop. Therefore, we have to apply the 18 to 20 foot rule. We have modified our language in the ADU ordinance to just reflect, 16 feet unless allowed under 66323. So we are trying to be.
I appreciate that. That was done well.
Yeah. Thank you. So we are trying our best to comply while also maintaining our local authority that we do not believe that it's a major transit stop. I'm also trying to coordinate with RTA because they've also qualified West Grand Avenue as a high quality transit corridor, which would then provide for that height to exceed to the rest of the city. So we're trying to work with RTA to get the right information out to HCD so that we can combat the misinformation that's being given to them. So work in progress, but for right now, we believe that the language we have in our code is compliant with state law while also maintaining our local authority to decide whether something's a major transit stop or not.
All right. Now, for attached ADUs, are units that are physically connected to the primary residence or an accessory structure. Attached ADUs may be up to 850 square feet or up to 1,000 square feet if the unit contains two or more bedrooms. However, the unit cannot exceed 50% of the existing floor area of the primary dwelling. Attached ADUs are not included in the state-exempt ADU provisions. In terms of height, the state allows attached ADUs to be constructed up to 25 feet or the height limit of the underlying zone, whichever is lower. Between local regulations and state law, it is important to understand what standards the city can apply and where the state law limits local discretion. For instance, the city may be more flexible with limitations and standards, but cannot be more restrictive than state law. Interior ADUs are also known as conversion ADUs, and JADUs are unique because they are created entirely within existing structures, such as an existing home or accessory building like a garage. Under Government Code 66314, cities may regulate interior ADUs through objective design standards, including size, provided these standards don't conflict with state law. However, state-exempt interior ADUs have no size limitation. JADUs, on the other hand, are smaller units limited to 500 square feet and also require the property is owner-occupied. There is no height limit for interior ADUs or JADUs since they are confined to existing structures.
And the junior ADU, you could meet the owner occupy by the owner living in the JADU and then renting out the main dwelling.
That is correct.
Just to pause for a moment, Commissioner Swift, you did have a couple of questions regarding the attached accessory dwelling units and the height, the 25-foot height limitation. Yeah. Did you want to address that before we moved on, or?
Yeah, I thought you were going to talk about. I guess we were going to talk about setbacks. Really, it was in relationship to setback requirements because you haven't talked setbacks at all yet.
And setbacks would be considered an objective standard. So it would be one of the limitations that state law would preempt us from being able to restrict if it otherwise constrains or prohibits construction of an ADU.
So state law allows ADUs to be as close as 4 feet to interior or rear property lines.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not specify max height, except for the transit business, right?
No, they did. There's four limitations for maximum height. I actually have a backup slide that shows the state law's limitations on maximum height for all scenarios, if we want to look at that.
Yeah, I think what I just wanted to make really clear is that the four-foot setback is not going to be a wide-open, we're going to have two-story, 25-foot ADUs built along everybody's back and side fences, that there are, with the current language that you've written, there are a few exceptions that the state law preempts the city, and attached ADUs is one of those few exceptions where there's no way to get around state law forcing the allowance of 25-foot attached ADUs that move the original dwelling with the ADU to within 4 feet of the back and side fence.
Correct, and that may also include a detached garage where the ADU is then attached on the second level of the garage. So that would be allowed to go up to 25 feet, and in a lot of cases, there are non-conforming garages right on property lines. That ADU would still be allowed to go up to 25 feet on that detached garage. So if you have a rear garage in a backyard, the state preempts local ordinance and would allow you to build a second story ADU on that garage up to 25 feet.
Even though it's a non-conforming garage to current code.
Correct.
And in fact is closer to the fence than even the state law allows.
Correct.
They would be allowed to put a second story ADU on that non-conforming garage.
Correct. Now, do we want 4 feet? Absolutely. But the state preempts us from being able to mandate that lower level come into compliance.
So there's a handful of exceptions, and maybe you'll talk about what those look like later. And then when you get to that section, I would also like to talk about what, because I think you told me that we can't apply objective design standards to these, but are there allowable standards, for example, for privacy where you don't have open bay windows looking into neighbors' yards? They have to be opaque windows like bathrooms.
Yes, if I can jump in here. Specifically for attached ADUs, which is the one with the concerning height here, the objective standards would apply. There is no state-exempt ADU for attached scenarios. So we've designed the objective design standards as part of the ADU ordinance to address the same kind of provisions that are within the single-family objective standards to ensure compatibility between design and privacy on adjoining lots.
Okay, so then let me pull that thread again.
Correct. Yeah, if I could just add one more note to that. we could not apply a greater setback than 4 feet, even if the ADU, the attached ADU is on the second story.
Okay, so you can't apply objective design standards that pull that second story back like we do in other taller buildings.
Correct. If the state is silent on what we would consider an objective design standard, ours would apply. If the state has a minimum or a maximum, for example, the 4 foot setback, we cannot apply a more restrictive setback or step back than the state would otherwise allow. So we couldn't pull that upper level back. They can meet that 4 foot minimum because the garage is already at that 4 feet.
So then excluding attached ADUs, whether that's attached to an existing detached garage or attached to an existing SFR, all of the other language that you put in does keep ADUs even within the 4 foot setback at either the 16 or 18 foot height limit. And it's only the attached ADUs either on a garage or on a house that become the two-story on a property line problem. Is that a fair summary?
That is an accurate statement, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions at this point, I suppose, before? Oh, we're at break for questions. So, did anyone else have questions?
Are you going to go over parking requirements for ADUs at some point?
I can, but the next phase of this is ADU combinations.
Oh, good. Okay.
I just wanted to say that we are looking at, thankfully, at every, you know, trying to anticipate every single possibility here. But, you know, I try to remember that risk is always the intensity of the hazard times the likelihood of it happening. And so, for example, how many garages are there that are within 4 feet of the lot line? You know, I don't know. Which you probably figured out from an aerial photo.
Just need to spend more time in the old crusty section of town.
I don't know.
Exactly. There's probably plenty.
You know, we're dealing with what we have, not with, you know, the perfect, you know, let's go for good.
And I think what I'm trying to actually address the vague, baseless fears and boogeymen, because worst case, we've just built ADUs at 25 feet on every single fence line in town. We might as well have zero lot line town. But the reality is not every ADU qualifies and not everybody is going to build an ADU. And so the number of units that fall in this invasion of privacy on the back fence scenario are going to be small, right?
I would agree with you.
It's available and somebody will take advantage of it, but it's going to be small. It won't be a small deal. The consequence for the person that has to look at that is high. Consequence for the rest of us is low because it didn't happen to us. And so that's really why I keep asking this question.
Yeah,
I want people to understand how likely it is to happen to them.
Ready to continue on?
Yeah.
Sorry. All right.
I'll wear out in a minute.
Actually, could we just take a quick break? I've got an individual at home, my mom. She says that there's no audio, and there hasn't been audio since 6:58.
Is our
Apologies for interrupting.
In the back. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name.
Deck, I can just walk back there.
Yeah.
Do you want to call a 5-minute break?
Yeah. Shall I recess this for 5 minutes until we can figure out the tech issue? All right. 5-minute recess. I think we have everyone back, right? All right. We were questions from commissioners break regarding the first part of the presentation. Did I catch everybody? Okay. Let us continue.
Now for ADU combinations. On single-family properties, state law permits a combination of different ADU types, which can significantly expand the housing options without changing the primary use of the site. A single-family lot may have one JADU, created entirely within the existing home, one interior or attached ADU, which may be regulated locally under Government Code 66314 or exempt under 66323.
So can I stop you there real quick? Explain the difference between a JADU and an interior ADU.
Essentially, the size limitations are different. There's different development standards that are applicable to either one. But essentially, they're the same function. And so it's an interior conversion of space. The reason why I put it next to the attached one is because you can do an either or for attached or interior, but it wouldn't be an either or for an interior or JADU. And I'll get to that. That will be at the end of the slide here. I'll explain kind of why that.
Okay.
My understanding is JADU does not require its own toilet and shower.
Correct. They can have shared facilities with the primary residence. That's correct.
But it would have to have some sort of kitchenette or cooking area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But they're very similar to how they function. Okay. So let's see. Attached ADUs, and then one detached ADU, which may also be proposed as either a locally regulated or a state-exempt ADU. It is important to note that while these combinations are allowed, the total number of units on the single-family property, including the primary residence, may not exceed 4. And so that's why it's important to have the distinction between what is allowed and so the interior and attached, you couldn't have both. You could do one or the other, so your maximum is 4. For multifamily and mixed-use properties, recent changes to state law have expanded ADU development opportunities, particularly through Senate Bill 1211. For properties with existing multifamily development, are allowed to build at least one interior ADU, plus additional interior ADUs up to 25% of the number of existing units. In addition, up to 8 detached ADUs are also permitted, provided they do not exceed the total number of existing units on the site. All ADUs on multifamily properties qualify as exempt ADUs. The proposed multifamily or mixed-use projects, that is, those that are not yet constructed, state law allows up to 2 detached ADUs.
So can
break for questions.
Yeah, so can I pull the vague, baseless, and boogeyman questions on that one as well? We've got a mixed-use or a multi-family property with conforming parking. So let's say it's an 8-plex, and it's got conforming parking for an 8-plex, and they choose to bulldoze half the parking lot and put in 4 ADUs in the parking lot of that 8-plex. Is that permitted under this current code?
Well, answer the yes, but I'll give the direct example.
Yes, it would be permitted, and there would be no replacement parking required.
So we have an actual pre-app that came in, just emails back and forth with a potential application that they're looking to submit. I think it's an existing 13-unit multifamily complex with attached, I think, 2-car garage as well as 2 covered carports. That's the only on-site parking, designated on-site parking. The rest of the folks park along the driveway, which runs street to street. So it's a through lot. So 13 units, they've got 2 carports, and then they've got
two garage spaces. So using the, if you could bring back the slide, I don't, oh, you guys can see it. So using the 25% rule, they are eligible to convert the two carports as well as the garage space into ADUs. And they're also proposing eight detached ADUs because they can do up to eight under this new state exempt ADU code. And it's going to be a two-story, 20-foot ADU unit.
May I interrupt for a moment? If there's sound at the back, could you please take that outside? It's the reverb from what we're doing in here. Okay.
No, it's the guys back here.
No, it's not the reverb.
I'll close the door.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. It's just, so I'm getting,
So the carports will be replaced with ADUs. Replacement parking is not required. The garages will be replaced with an ADU. Parking replacement's not required. And the two-story detached eight ADU unit will be placed on the lot, and parking is not required. So this is what we're being handed by the state. These are the applications that we'll have to process, and they're completely ministerial, not subject to objective design standards, but we're working really hard to push to the applicant. You need to take into consideration the impact that this will have on the residential neighborhood immediately adjacent. How, and so we're asking the question, how will you notify your neighbors? How will you notify the occupants of this development? Here are our objective design standards that we typically require. You may consider these in order to be more compliant with or consistent with the neighborhood character overall. But we have no local control over these applications.
So that really is sort of the extreme application.
And it's here.
And it's completely...
It is out of our control.
So, and so this feeds my question to you earlier about parking, right? Is that that's a perfect example where you're going to take 13 current units with probably 25 parking spaces to serve those 13 current units?
I don't think they're conforming for parking.
Okay, so... Let's say that there's 13 parking. Each one had one. So they already had half of their family parking someplace else. And you're going to effectively double the number of occupants with cars and eliminate all the parking, which
Correct.
Will move every single one of their vehicles to the street.
Correct.
And the only way that they can park on the street is if they move their car every 72 hours to more than 300 feet away or they get a ticket.
Yeah, I think silver lining, that is 10 additional accessory dwelling units that are available for rent. It's a rental property. Those would be for rent. So it'd be providing additional housing in this community that desperately needs it. As it relates to the 72-hour parking rule, as you saw in my response in the email, you know, I coordinated closely with our police chief as well as our police department on this, and ADUs are going to be treated no differently than a single-family residential unit. We're going to assume that these folks work and those cars are going to be moving. So the only complaints that we would get would be from a neighbor who just doesn't want to see the vehicle potentially on the street. And we would make sure to inform both the owner of said vehicle as well as the complainant what the rules are and when it is appropriate to make said complaint. As far as, again, this is what I provided to you in the email, but as far as proactive enforcement, you know, our community services technicians that are under our police department, you know, if they see leaves underneath a tree, if they see cobwebs building up on a vehicle, they will tag it. And if it's still there 72 hours later, we'll ticket it. But if a car moves, you know, daily because that individual is going to their job, they're not going to actively be tagging vehicles that they see on the street.
But if there was a complaint lodged by somebody in the neighborhood
yep.
for that specific
they
vehicle that always comes back and parks in that spot, even though it leaves during the day, it would get tagged to be moved.
Potentially. If the service technician goes out and sees that it's not there in that spot, then it's moved. If it comes back to the exact same spot, they were lucky to find the spot, and then they'll tag it. And if it's not there the next day, then it doesn't meet the 72-hour requirement. It's just a cycle. We assume that these individuals will be working, the vehicles will move. There isn't really a concern from Grover Beach PD's perspective. However, your broader concern that the lack of parking is an issue, we share that same concern, especially as it relates to parking regs under state ADU law.
So recognizing that we have this pending parking problem, do you have any idea what the city's plan is for parking?
We continue to rely on our city's code and our parking regulations. Those parking regulations are informed by the, as referenced earlier, the Institute of Transportation Engineers parking manual, parking generation manual. Every discretionary project that comes before you is likely to require some level of a traffic study, but that's also determined by our public works and city engineer as to whether or not it's necessary. Typically, a traffic study is and mitigations only required, is it 100 peak hour? I think it's 100.
Yeah, it's a VMT threshold, yeah.
Yeah, so there's
let me ask the question differently. Who owns the pending parking problem? Is it Public Works? Is it your office? Is it City Council? Somebody is going to have that land on them to find a solution.
Absolutely. But at this time, as Commissioner Halverson's spoken time and time again, it's out of our council's hands as well. This is preempted by the state. So what we can do is look ahead at other projects that come forward to identify whether there is an issue. However, Grover Beach, for as much as there could be a perceived issue of parking, all of our parking is available, and we have not received any complaints to date of available on street parking.
Yeah, I think
so.
I think Commissioner Swift is looking a little bit into the future.
Yeah,
but maybe not too far.
Maybe not. I mean, just down the street, our neighbors at City of Santa Maria, they get calls very frequently regarding the breakup of the character of their single family residential neighborhoods. Their families can't park in front of their homes to visit them. Is this a real issue? Absolutely. Is it something that we're tracking and trying to work and coordinate regionally on how to solve it? Absolutely. Do I have the answer for you today? No. Is it an issue today? No. But it doesn't mean that we're pushing it aside. So we've committed to annual review of our development code. One of the things that we want to tackle next is this exact issue, along with our subdivision regulations and our non-conforming sections of our code. But this is coming. We're not blind to it, and we hear you. We're also powerless, which is also why we want to make sure that we provide a presentation that shows you exactly where our authority lies and where it doesn't. We are here to provide you the information and for you to make those recommendations of policy change to council. And I think that that's a really important card to hold. And then if our council can direct us to then work on those parking regulations, it's something that we will.
You just answered my question. You passed it to us to make those recommendations to council to address it through staff.
That is our role to you, your role to council.
Perfect. So we own the problem.
Royal we.
You don't want me to own this problem.
The royal we owns the problem. Yeah, the city itself.
I mean, there's no easy way out of this.
Have we hit the point where we're talking about parking and not ADUs?
Well, this is all wrapped up. The only reason we're having a parking, one of the reasons we're having a parking issue is because of ADUs.
We're going to meet the minimum state requirements with the changes that are being made,
mm-hmm.
and what are the unintended consequences of meeting those minimum state requirements. And I think that's part of this exercise is not only understanding that so we know what to do in terms of recommendations, but also so we know how to educate the public as to how they may feel the unintended consequences of meeting state law.
Okay.
Does that seem fair?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I completely agree.
And before carrying on, I could quickly pull up the backup slide I have about the parking requirements under state law, just so you can see them for yourself real quick.
I believe you.
Okay. All right, ready to get back into it then?
We don't like it, but we believe you.
All right. Now for the actual updates. The ordinance has been updated to reflect specific guidance provided by HCD to ensure full compliance with state law. First, the maximum number of ADUs permitted on both single-unit and multi-unit properties has been adjusted to match current state law allowances. including combinations of JADUs, interior attached, and detached units. Secondly, we revised the maximum height limitations for detached ADUs. These updates ensure that our local standards reflect what's required under state law, including higher allowances in areas near the train station and flexibility for pitched roofs. Third, we've also clarified that state-exempt ADUs are exempt from local objective design standards. This distinction is important to ensure that we do not unintentionally apply regulations that state law explicitly preempts. In response to HCD's feedback, we have made several additional updates to the ADU regulations. The owner occupancy requirement for junior accessory dwelling units now includes exemptions for certain qualifying agencies and organizations, such as government entities, land trusts, and nonprofits, consistent with state law. The prior requirement for an ADU covenant agreement has been removed entirely, as it is not authorized under state law. Meanwhile, the JEDU covenant agreement has been amended to also reflect those same owner occupancy exemptions. Lastly, we clarified the alternative compliance language to explicitly state that the development standards shall not physically preclude the construction of at least one attached or detached ADU of up to 800 square feet. This ensures that our standards align with state mandates and don't create unintended barriers to ADU development. The revisions to the ADU ordinance are administrative in nature and will not cause any direct or indirect physical changes to the environment. As a result, they are exempt from review under CEQA. Following the Planning Commission's recommendation and City Council's consideration, staff will submit the approved changes to the California Coastal Commission. Once the Coastal Commission approves the city's local coastal program, these updates will take effect throughout both the inland and coastal areas of the city. And tonight's recommendation is for the Planning Commission to forward the changes to City Council for final adoption and approve the associated local coastal program amendment. This concludes the staff's presentation, and I'm available for any more questions.
Do we have more questions for staff?
No, I guess we have questions for our state legislature.
Yeah. I have a couple more questions, and maybe this is, if these are more appropriate at the end for council comments and you're going to be here to answer them, you can push me off till the end. But I had two more cases that I didn't completely understand on the code. The first one is ADUs and ADUs on urban lot splits. And what I was trying to understand is the distinction between an urban lot split and a property subdivision, where, for example, you have a large lot that can be carved into two conforming lots. And is that considered an urban lot subdivision and therefore restricted to how many units can go on it? Or is it two conforming lots that now can have the maximum number of four dwellings on them in an R1? This is an R1 question.
I think it's appropriate for the item, and we have a backup slide for you.
Oh, thank you.
Here we go. All right. So for urban lot splits, so the two scenarios you described is a standard subdivision and also an urban lot split. Urban lot splits are housed under a state law called SB9, also known as a Home Act. Urban lot splits have a lot of limitations with them and allow for pretty small lot subdivisions. So let's start with a standard subdivision. You have a standard, say, 12,000 square foot R1 lot, and you want to divide into two properties. You have two conforming lots. Both those lots would be eligible for the ADU state law requirements, just the same as any other property. Versus an urban lot split scenario, there is a higher limitation on the number of units that can be presented in any combination of the lot splits. So for an urban lot split, you are essentially limited to four units on either resulting property. So two on one, two on the other, no more than that. Whatever that ADU combination is, or whether it's a two primary units, it's not going to exceed that threshold. And that's a covenant agreement that gets recorded with the property when the urban lot split is recorded, so that both those properties are subject to that limitation.
And what makes the urban lot split unique or specific from the two conforming lots? Is it that they're allowed to be smaller, they have shared space, they have common areas? What's the distinction?
Yes, and so there's a lot of layers there. The primary one is a smaller size. So the split for an urban lot split is 40-60, and so meaning that if you have a 6,000 square foot lot, One of the lots would have to be at least 40% of the overall maximum size of the lot, and the other one has to be 60%. They can't be any smaller than that ratio, but they both could be 50%, et cetera. There's also reduced setbacks, so any SB9 application project is also eligible for that 4-foot setback, and that includes a first story, second story, and it's all ministerial. So no projects within SB9 are subject to any public hearing, any sort of public noticing, or any discretionary action.
But the answer is for an urban lot split, it's a 4 total dwelling units maximum. For a split that produces 2 conforming lots that meet minimum lot size requirements, it's up to 4 on each of the lots.
Correct.
Of the various combinations of primary dwelling and ADU. Okay.
How many SB9? Because SB9, I think, went through in 2022, maybe?
I think correct.
How many have we had?
Yeah, about 9. Yeah.
Just under a dozen. In a city of 12,500 with what, 4,900?
The owner occupancy lots? The owner occupancy stipulation, a lot of folks are deterred from pursuing SB9 just for that. Additionally, a lot of folks that are interested in pursuing SB9 aren't aware of the demolition prohibition if you have a current tenant on the lot. So if you have a single family residence on your lot that you want to split, but there's a tenant currently occupying it or occupied it within the last 3 years, you're not allowed to demo said residence. And a lot of the properties that folks have shown interest in, that home is essentially dilapidated and no longer habitable. And so it makes it difficult for them to pursue it. So just those two items alone make these more difficult to apply for. Yeah.
Thanks.
So my last question is another case study. Is if you had a, and we have a few of those around here, you have a large residential lot that has a single family home on it, but has since been rezoned into a R2 or R3 zone. If it's not already multifamily, so still SFR, but big and zoned for multifamily, how would you apply these rules to that R2 or R3 lot, which is a multifamily lot with a single family dwelling on it?
Yeah, so state law doesn't really look at zoning for the allowances for ADUs. So if a single family residence exists on a property, it's eligible for the same ADU provisions as any other single family property on an R1 zone. What that means is that if it's a large enough lot and can accommodate a future multifamily development, it would remain eligible to do so. However, we probably look pretty closely at those ADUs to make sure that they're not in addition to what you can provide as a multifamily so that the overall numbers would align. And we probably work closely with HCD to make sure that we address that legally.
So it sounds like they could go the ADU route and get the 4. Or they could look at whether they're better off developing it as a multifamily development and getting whatever the conforming number of units is for the density for that piece of property.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. It's complicated.
It is. Any other questions for staff at this time? We have people waiting very patiently for public comment.
On the phone.
We had 2 questions that I think have gotten answered, but Ms. Westphal, if you had any other questions on the ADU issue, I will open public comment for the folks in the room, and then we'll go to the phone line in case there's someone there.
All right, I will mark my slip a lot. I may have missed it. On the ADUs, are they all going to be on... since they're going to be new and built, are they still going to be on the existing sewer line and meter line? Like I said, you may have already addressed it and I missed it. Also, as far as parking, even though I know parking is not on the agenda pretty much, but parking. I know I have experienced, I have 2 to 3 parking spaces in front of my property currently. However, 1 vehicle takes up all those spaces every single night. Is there a way that residents can have the city or get their own spray paint can and mark parking spots so not one car is taking up two or three spots, and those three spots can be clearly marked that they're three spots. Secondly, another thing the city can consider on creating 44 parking spaces is go back to Newport and rip out those bulb outs, because those bulb outs took out two parking spaces on each side per corner. So that I pretty much counted, it could be up to 44 parking spaces that's going to be able to create if you get rid of those bulb outs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Auer?
So I just want to reiterate back to what I asked earlier. Take into consideration when we approve taking 13 apartments and allowing them now to be double the amount, parking is going to be a problem. But for the last 2 years, I've heard we have no water. We have no water. Sky's falling. We have no water. Then we got miracle rain. But don't you think the state would consider, if we have a water issue, not forcing us to do all the building? We've already built more than our share for San Luis Obispo to get the pats on the back. We accomplished that. Mission accomplished. But any future developments, any more ADUs, we need to consider where the water source is going to come from. Just think about that, okay? Because, again, we heard, and I still hear my city manager on occasion say, water, water, we don't have water. Thank God we have water today. But let's think about that before we start adding, you know, 20 toilets at a time, right? It's just something to consider. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone on the line for public comment? All right, we'd like to hear from you.
Hello.
You still there? Hi.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, we
Hi.
Can hear you.
My name is Kimmy Norin. Hi. I'm calling as an advocate with Low County EMB. Thank you for taking these steps to align the city's zoning code with California's housing and ADU laws. Your leadership really, really matters. I'd like to make my comment more of an anecdote about height and the supposed eventual costs we're putting on people who have to tolerate their neighbor's two-story ADU or an ADU kind of close to the property line. I used to live in a neighborhood that at the very entrance of the street that I lived on, 1 year, the owners decided to paint their home various shades of purple, like bright purple, okay? And that was, like, definitely a huge shock on the first day. I think I hated it as much as I've probably ever hated an inanimate object. I was like, what possessed these people? Why that shade of purple? I wish I lived in an HOA with rules against it. And then as time went on, the weird thing was I got used to it, and then it became part of the landscape. And it became something odd and funny that I pointed out to visitors when I had them over. That is something as humans we can do. It's we can adapt to changes in our environment. We can find creative solutions to things. I understand the concerns about privacy for ADUs. Someone being able to see into your backyard or side yard, if you're not very close with them, that's a concern. You can fix it with not much more than some fruit trees, umbrellas, or partitions. I think someone on staff mentioned opaque glass. I think that's part of living in a community that has vitality and that is seeing new investment and construction. I'd much rather have that for Grover Beach and deal with some of the mental trauma of a two-story ADU rather than be in a place where there's no economic growth and there's no new people moving in, where there's a really low quality of life. I think there's other places in California that are dealing with those issues, and those are not our issues. We're living through, like, the worst cost of living crisis in generations, so please don't be precious about someone's visual experience over literally providing homes for people. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comment. Is there anyone else on the line?
No, there's not.
And I don't believe, so the one correspondence we got was dealing with both 3 and 4, so I will go ahead and close public comment. Okay. And now, commissioners, do we want to discuss anything amongst ourselves? I keep calling you chair.
I know.
Commissioner Halverson.
It's the way I carry myself.
You did so well.
I know. Thank you. There's not much to say here. I think staff has done a great job putting in all of the mirrored requirements from the state, and we don't have any choice on those. And much as I'd like to debate all of this density increase and question the impacts to water and sewer and parking, we can't. So here we are, trying to deal with the repercussions which will be coming. My time is up, apparently. No.
I don't think we restrict you to 3 minutes, do we?
Okay. Well, that's good. Now I lost my train of thought. I know. Well, so it comes down to us. Our responsibility is to pass this on to the City Council, and part of that responsibility is to bring to their attention the concerns that we do have and perhaps some solutions. I think striping the streets is a great solution. Maybe not just the parallel parking way, but maybe we do diagonal parking on the wider streets that would accommodate more cars. There's probably some innovative things rather than the city buying a bunch of parking lots and spreading them out throughout the city to take the place of on-street or on-site parking for the developments. But we're going to have to start thinking about those things because some of them are going to involve, well, all of them are going to involve money. And so we have to start allocating finances to look at those, look at other cities who are facing the same thing, because I'm sure we're not the only ones in California facing these same problems because of these same requirements. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Holden. Vice Chair Swift.
I always have questions.
I know you do. I love that.
So from the public comments and also from the YIMBY caller, one thing that popped in my head is that if the city meets its RENA numbers, can they pause building or issuing permits for ADUs? I mean, is there any mechanism for moratorium on building once mandated housing numbers are met?
No, but I'd look to our deputy city attorney, Ms. Thompson, to respond to that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Meeting your RENA numbers does help with some sorts of approval authorities and the ability to stop certain types of developments, but ADUs is not one of them.
So ADUs, they will continue without any control whatsoever?
It seems that way. Yeah, and I mean, for what it's worth, the parking issues that I've heard tonight, I've heard in probably every city is dealing with these same issues. And from what we can tell, the state doesn't intend to address them.
And the League of California Cities hasn't helped us at all.
I mean, I think we can continue to conduct outreach, but specific to parking, no. I think their focus has been permit streamlining for housing in general. But I don't think that it's lost on anybody that this is an afterthought that's in the profession. It's just a matter of who's going to step up and start trying to address it, and what will the state then allow us to address? And we don't have an answer for that.
And I just saw news that there's changes to CEQA coming from the governor's office. Is that going to have any major impact on what you've done so far with this code?
So I forwarded that to Ms. Thompson, and I think that it may, as it relates to higher density housing. But we're still looking at how that might affect us, and we just started that research, I mean, with the
today.
News that came out yesterday. Right. So I forwarded it last night, and she responded this morning.
We haven't had a time to fully absorb it yet, but yeah, there's potential impacts for sure.
And I do appreciate the way you captured my concern in the language for the two stories on the fence line. I think that one, you heard me, and I appreciate that. And two, I also think it at least somewhat state-proofs the code for a little while, because it has the hooks in there should something change in that determination. So for now, I think you did a great job addressing my concerns and still meeting the requirements from the state. So thank you.
I'll just say, contrary in opinion, I think we've hit peak car. Young people don't want to drive. old folks should not be driving. And we need some homes for those folks to live in. I know, no one wants to admit it. My dad just turned 81. He thinks he's going to drive till 100. I hope he doesn't. But, you know, I feel like some of y'all haven't lived car-free and had that extra $6,000 to $10,000 a year to spend. It's not bad. And some people would choose to have an extra $6,000 to $10,000 a year and not have a car, and maybe they need to rent one once a month to do their big shopping or whatever. We have buses that run. They could be better, more frequent. But there's plenty of people who don't have cars who need homes. So, and I think we're going to see more of that. So, you know, we will see how it goes here. But I'm not as concerned as the rest of y'all about the parking situation. And I think what's nice about ADUs is it gets us closer to, you know, we have the 5th and 14th Amendments in the U.S. Constitution that protect property rights and your ability to make full use of your property. And exclusionary zoning and control has infringed upon that. And so I think we're trying to strike a balance here of giving a bit more freedom to people so that if they do need, they are older, but they want to have their family move in, they can move into a smaller unit and have their family right there to help them age in their neighborhood. I don't think you should have to move out of your neighborhood when you turn 80 and you can't drive anymore. So that's how I feel about that. Any other comments?
I have one more question.
Okay.
You never talked about minimum size, but there's a 150 square foot minimum size on ADUs. What was the origin of that requirement?
So the state law says that we have to establish a minimum threshold that allows for what's considered an efficiency unit.
Can you turn your mic on, I think?
Oh, is it not on?
Is it?
So state law does have a minimum threshold for ADUs to allow for an efficiency unit, so we can't preclude that ability. And so we matched the definition of efficiency unit under state law at 150 square feet so that we are consistent. We could have not provided it, but smaller than 150 square feet probably wouldn't qualify as a unit.
Well, so it precludes people converting their accessory structures, which are allowed to be 120 square feet.
I believe there is a building code limitation on the amount of square footage for habitable space, independent living of habitable space, and I think it matches 150 square feet, okay, if I remember correctly. I think anything less than that wouldn't qualify as a unit. It would qualify as like a detached habitable space. I believe there's a different minimal threshold for that, too. It's been a minute since I looked at that.
So Chair, yes. I don't think we answered the questions that we had from the public.
Did we? Let me look back. I think I wrote them down. I feel like they got.
Well, for instance, do ADU applications have to come to the Planning Commission for approval? Was the first one that I wrote down. Yes. And I think the answer is no, unless there is some sort of exception to the code that we have to review and approve. There's many, many. In fact, the city already has, two or three standard ADU designs online that people can just pull off and they're automatically approved because we gave them to them. So that was the first
question. The other was the notification, and I believe the answer is no.
Yeah, for ministerial or projects that do not require the discretion of our Planning Commission, there's no state or local mandate that requires posting of building permit. So no, the posting is not required for ADUs or for any building permit itself. But if it's a discretionary project, then the posting occurs at least 10 days prior to the public hearing notice to alert those in the vicinity of what's happening.
For example, an ADU with a coastal development permit would require that noticing. So ADUs in the coastal zone have their own different noticing requirements.
There was also a question on height limits, 25 feet versus 15 feet, as well as is it different than single versus multifamily? But I believe that we covered that, but happy to bring the slide back up if your commission feels we need to address it.
No. I think I got it.
Okay.
And I have one more question here that was written down about the existing connections to sewer lines. So state law says that state exempt ADUs, we are not allowed to mandate a connection, a separate connection for an ADU. However, locally regulated ADUs, we are allowed to require a separate connection, but the city of Grove Beach does not currently, and that's not currently in our policies. So right now we do not permit a second connection for an ADU. They would have to connect to their primary in the city of Grove Beach at this time.
Which seems like it would reduce the amount of water sitting in pipes, right? Because you wouldn't
Hopefully
have a separate pipe going.
Hopefully the water doesn't sit in the pipe. It flows down.
Yes.
I think pulling the thread on that one a little more, I think the underlying question there was, does it address the current problem where you've got a multi-units on a single meter that are being charged phantom multi-accounts, right? So let's take your four-unit case. So you've got four ADUs on a lot, and they're all on the same meter. Would that be treated as four accounts on the same meter and therefore always paying the high-tier water? Again, are we creating a known problem and exaggerating it?
Under the state law, we would not be permitted to require a separate connection for those ADUs. They would have to connect to the primary or existing. Or if the developer was interested in pursuing a separate connection, that's something they can work out with our public works department, but we would not be able to mandate it.
And I also think we might be getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. This is something that I believe our council is going to be taking into consideration at a future meeting. So it is something that we can also table for discussion until council gives direction to staff on how we want to look at multifamily sites and how we want metering to work for these multifamily sites so we don't run into that issue.
Yeah, but it will be taken up. Because this makes the current problem much worse.
Yeah. So we'll see where council goes with it, and our public works director, Mr. Greg Ray, will be at the helm of that.
Are we ready for a motion on item four?
Sure.
I invite one.
All right. I move that we approve. It's not a development application. I move that we accept the amendments to the city code and recommend them to the city council for approval.
I will second that motion.
Clerk Ratana, would you please take the roll?
Commissioner Halverson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Swift?
Yes.
Commissioner Holden?
Yes.
And Chair Mann?
Yes. Motion passes unanimously. Moving on, we have no regular business items. Are there any other commissioner comments? And I will go through everyone's name. We've had a pretty good discussion already tonight. Commissioner Halverson?
Sure. So I think, is this the part where we talk about our recommendations to the city council as regard to the ADU? Okay. And I don't know what form you want that to be. And I think you've already heard pretty much our concerns. And you probably already shared the same ones, but you can say they're from us now. And maybe a few recommendations that we came up with and the public came up with. So I don't know if anybody else has anything to add to that recommendation to the city council. David.
So I think can I
move on to Commissioner Holden and then we'll go in order.
Yeah.
Commissioner Holden, did you have any other? Okay. Just want to respect the flow.
The flow.
Vice Chair Swift.
So on Commissioner Halverson's point, I think the last time I think I actually may have even addressed the council on the topic that they had before them. And they returned it to the Planning Commission. And I will probably go before the council again when this comes up with them and raise the concerns that were raised tonight, not in so much as the way the code is written, because I think Megan and her team have done a great job of capturing the changes. But I do think they need to be fully aware of both the public's concern and my concerns with how this sort of plays out in the long term. And so I will address the council if we want to have a common address and one deliver. I don't know if that's how we would do it. That's probably a question for legal counsel. But do we carry this as individuals to the council? Do we carry this as a recommendation from Planning Commission to the council beyond approve?
Well, are you speaking as a neighbor, or you want to speak for all of us?
Yeah, I think staff, Ms. Martin, should probably speak for us in their presentation to council. Because they're going to tell them part of the process was it came to us.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we approved it and recommended it be moved on, but we have these concerns, and I think she can present those. And you can certainly fortify that in your own statement.
Yeah, I think if I plan on speaking to the council, I certainly will not surprise you with anything I say.
Yeah, just understanding that when you're before the council like that, you're speaking as an individual.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
So, any other questions or comments for staff? David?
I was just looking at my notes and thinking.
Sorry, there's two Davids down there.
Yeah, I think I would just like to say again, I really do appreciate the work you guys did in bringing this back with the language changes. And I, being a simple man, I really liked the pictures that you brought up to sort of educate us on what it really meant for the state requirements. That was very helpful. I hope people go back and watch this to understand kind of what the state has gotten us into. So I appreciate that work, and we'll work with what we have.
Yeah. I also want to thank staff, all of you. This is a ton of work. You're very skilled at it, and I appreciate it. I did want to ask, so we are 5 years into the current RENA cycle. Is that correct? What year does the, so then 2028 will be when we need to adopt another housing element. So what is the timeline in advance of that? Because there will need, in order to, depending on what our numbers are then, we'll need to figure out additional zoning and other changes. And I think, like, we've had a couple of sort of midpoint development code updates. But that might be the next big one that we do. So can you give us an idea of the planning timeline for that?
Yeah, so we're actually really excited about this. So as of right now, our city council just adopted a budget, which includes a request from my department for in the fiscal year 26, beginning fiscal year 26, for $200,000 to hire a qualified consultant to prepare our next housing element update. So my goal as the director of the department is to issue an RFP and have somebody on hand prior to July 1 of 2026, at which point we will start extensive public outreach as well as this next cycle of our housing element update. So July 1 of 2026 will be the kickoff. And we hope to bring that to our council prior to the end of 2027. Just a little bit of background information, but I can go into more detail if needed. And Mr. Bell is also available for any questions. But we are still waiting on our numbers from, so we coordinate through the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, also known as SLOCOG, in identifying our build-out numbers and then ultimately helping us to inform what our RENA numbers should be that are then handed down by HCD. A lot of things go into that calculation, that formula, including Department of Finance. They look at migration, they look at mortality, they look at birth rates, they look at absolutely everything, and it all goes into what our RENA numbers might be. As of right now, our preliminary numbers show that our build out is less than what we had previously anticipated. And this is very common. Over time, different areas, cities just see different migration and birth rate patterns and mortality patterns. So we're still currently working on that through SLOCOG. And once we receive those RENA numbers, we'll then be able to plug that into our housing element and actually be able to give you a better picture on whether or not upzoning different areas is even necessary. So I can't speak to the details of that yet, but once we have it, we'll be bringing it back for multiple public engagement and public outreach sessions. We'll have, I'm sure, multiple planning commission meetings, possibly some joint city council and planning commission meetings with the desired adoption in the fall of 2027, and then it'll need to be approved by HCD ultimately.
Okay.
As well as the Coastal Commission, because we
great. So we're
coastal.
In some ways, the ADU changes that we're seeing now are kind of doing a bit of that upzoning work for us, right?
Well, our housing element will identify the policies by which we then create the code to build ADUs. But housing element will essentially have policies that say provide opportunity in your code to have ADUs. And then our development code then provides that actual formula to build an ADU. So I don't know that we'll see much change as it relates to our housing element. I think the biggest change that we're looking forward to and what's going to be a majority of the work is recent state legislation just in 2021, 2022. It's called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And it's essentially a survey that's going to need to be conducted citywide, and it'll look at the intricacies of the socioeconomic factors in our community. So it will look at location of schools. It'll look at home values. It'll look at grocery locations. It'll look at a number of factors. In fact, I can bring up more details. I've got a questionnaire that a consultant just recently provided us. We did some outreach and asked what can we expect moving forward. So there's a number of things that go into this study that they do, and that will then inform your commission as well as our council on policy that we may need to consider in order to evenly distribute whether it be housing or other socioeconomic factors of development in our community. It's essentially an attempt to redistribute equity and equality across the community. So a lot of it specifically focuses on environmental justice, overarching environmental justice policies and DEI policies that a city should be taking into consideration when looking at how it's going to build over time. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of information.
It's going to make your job much more complicated.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. This is the work we signed up to do, right?
So they didn't teach me this in graduate school, but yes, this is now what I've signed up for.
All right. Any other comments from the commissioners? Then I will invite the Community Development Director's report from Director Martin.
Great. Not too much of an update for you. Our Cleaver and Clark Commons, I am happy to announce that they have distributed pamphlets and flyers to the city. They're available in our right out here in our lobby. Thank you so much. So many other words that I've spoken this evening. They're available out here in our lobby. You can also email us and ask, but they are pre-applications for the Cleaver and Clark Commons 53-unit affordable housing complex. It's just right down here at 1206 West Grand. They are still intending for December occupancy, with full occupancy coming in January. So partial occupancy in December, final occupancy in January. Also, a little bit of a delay in construction at 950 El Camino Real. We had hoped for summer, and then we hoped for fall, and it looks like November occupancy. So we're competing a little bit with the market in Paso Robles. They are also booming in development right now, and they have a hotel that's under construction. And so they're getting, it's the same company that's doing the work in both communities. So they're focusing on that and plan to have occupancy of the 950 El Camino Real hotel in November. Exciting news, our summer concert series begins July 13th. And just a reminder to your commission as well as to the community, this is at 16th Street Park. So Ramona's currently under construction. And so we'll be starting that this year over at 16th Street Park. Also, just circling back to our accessory dwelling units and to the presentation that was provided this evening, our staff will also upload the presentation to the ADU program page. So under our community development website, we have a programs page, and specific to accessory dwelling units, you can go online and there's photos that describe everything that was included here this evening. We'll also include that presentation and the graphics that Mr. Bell has put together for us. So, but just another great page that I'm super proud of and our team has built to, again, just communicate as much as possible to the public. And then lastly, it is July 1, and 2025 building code cycle update. So this will need to be adopted prior to the end of this calendar year. It is not something that typically comes before the Planning Commission, but I did want to make you aware that we will be presenting a first draft to the council. Our goal is October And with the goal of final adoption in November, we'll then have to submit it to the state state board for their approval. But just a heads up that our 2025 building code cycle update has begun. So a lot of energy code updates, and we've got a team of folks that'll be letting us know whether there's anything that we need to amend pursuant to our local code. Otherwise, it's this likely wouldn't just be a clean adoption. There probably will be some amendments to our local code, but otherwise it's just an adoption of an acknowledgement of the 2025 new code cycle. So pursuing that, and I think that's it, unless you have any other questions for me about things going on in Grover Beach.
Any questions? Commissioner Halverson?
No.
Commissioner Holden? No. Vice Chair Swift?
No.
Regarding the building code, is that something where single staircase reform would sit?
Potentially, and it is in my list of items that I'll be going over with our building team next week on Wednesday. So,
does everyone know what I'm talking about with single staircase reform? So for multifamily homes over a certain number of units, it's required to have two staircases, which results in having those long corridors like we saw in Palladium. And a single staircase is much more popular all over the world. It's a fire code thing.
Yes.
I think goes back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in this country. But it appears so many other countries have proven, and some cities in this country have shown a single staircase for six or eight units is no more dangerous than, you know, insisting there's two. You always have another egress, but it allows you to have much more attractive and functional apartments and condos because you can have light on three sides instead of just one. So at the moment, I believe California State Legislature approved a study a few years ago. And so should something happen at the state level with that, it'd be nice to have something ready to go in our code that once it gets approved. Because for small lots like we have here, I think it would be really beneficial.
Yeah. Oh. And again, it's on our list along with a couple of other items that your commission's brought up in the past. For example, the outlet requirement. So just looking at all of at the bottom of staircases and hallways, et cetera. So there's also little things that we've included that we're not sure if it's necessarily something that can be incorporated into it, but we do take your comments and we include it as part of our options for updating.
Yeah, and I mean, some things are like nice to have, so they don't necessarily have to be mandated.
Yeah.
But, all right. I believe we are at the end. I will adjourn this meeting at 8:16. Thank you, everyone.
Sorry for all the questions that dragged up.